אתם ניצבים היום כולכם לפני השם אלוקיכם, ראשיכם, שפתיכם, זקניכם ושוטריכם, כל איש ישראל. So everyone is gathered together on this particular day. Rashi tells us about the poignancy of this particular speech and this particular day. Atem nitzavim, if we'll just let our eyes wander to the beginning of source number two, milamid shekinsam Moshe lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu biyom moto lachnisam bivrit. That this is the final day of Moshe's life. Moshe is going to die this day. According to our Mesorah, this would therefore be on the seventh day of Adar. This is the final part of the speech. You know, one of the challenges that we have throughout Sefer Devarim is being able to determine how many speeches we have. Is it one long speech, a series of speeches? But what Rashi over here is informing us is that starting right now, this is the final speech. This is the multiple covenants, and this will be the final covenant prior to... part of this is the same challenge that I've been saying, is that how many speeches are there with... Generally, we say two. Continue back on the top. Pasuk Yud. Tabchem nishechem v'gircha shebekerev machanecha michote veitzecha choyv mimecha. La'avricha bivrit Hashem Elokecha uva'aloto asher Hashem Elokecha kareit imcha hayom. So over here, it seems to be that there is a new covenant being established today, right now, again on this final day. Pasuk Yud Bet gives us the rationale. Leman hikim otcha hayom lo la'am, u'yelecha lelokim kasher diber loch, v'kasher nishba levotecha la'avrom Yitzchak Yaakov. So this is in order to establish you as a people. And again, I'll just say in passing, what one could do, or perhaps should do, but we won't do, would be to do a precise analysis between this covenant and between a previous one, and what exactly is included now versus what was included previously. And there is overlap, and one of the points of the overlap we mentioned, we went into depth last year, and that's regarding the next pasuk. V'lo itchem levadchem anochi kareit et habrit hazot v'tela hazot. Not only you exclusively are included within this covenant, pasuk yedalet, ki et asher yeshno po imanu omed hayom lefnei Hashem elokeinu v'et asher einenu po imanu hayom. Those who are here and those who aren't here. Now, for some, we talked about last year is that for some reason the Gemara imagines that this pasuk is said at Har Sinai and not said right now by Arvot Moav. And it uses it, and you can look up the various the apparatus in the Makrot Gedola that will refer you back to the sources of Chazal, or use other places that go back to Chazkar Tamima, others. This pasuk is used again and again to refer to Sinai, even though the pasuk is actually stated within the context of the Brit, which is being established right now. It means a vow, an oath. If we go back now to Rashi in source number two. In Pasuk Yud Bet, when God says, I'll make you for a people, Rashi adds, Lefi shediber lecha v'nishba levotecha shelo lahachlif et zaram b'uma acheret. That part of the issue over here is that the Jews would never be exchanged for a different people. Unfortunately, this is one of the things that we endured during the Galut, those who claimed that they were in fact the true Israel and we had been exchanged. Rashi tells us that's the reason why this is being done with an oath. And then, towards the next line, he said, Ad kan pirashti lefi pshuto shel parsha. Until now, I've been telling you pshat. Rashi tells us in other places that he sees his mandate to be to explain things through pshat, even though Rashi very often will deviate from his own self-described mandate. U'midrash agada, lama nismecha parsha atem nitzavim leklalot. So it's asking, why is this Parshat Nitzavim, immediately after Kitavo, where we have all of these curses, Lefi sheshem'u Yisrael mea klalot chaser shtayim, which is an easier way of saying 98. There were 98 different things, or curses, which were enumerated last week. Chutz me'arbeim v'teisha shebetarat kohanim, aside from the 49 negative things or curses that were said in the Tochacha, the rebuke in Sefer Vayikra. Horiku pneim v'amru, mi yuchol hamod be'elu. The Jews, after hearing all of this negativity, finally said, who can possibly survive this? Who could? How are we going to make it as a people, hearing all of this either prophecy or promise or prediction of negativity. Hitchil Moshe lefaisam otam. Slicha lefaisam. Moshe, he tried to pacify them. Atem nitzavim hayom. You're standing strong today. You're here. Atem nitzavim. Harbe hich'astem lemakom. This is the way he's going to cheer them up. Harbe hich'astem lemakom. V'lo asa itchem kliya. That you've gotten God quite angry in the past number of years, and he didn't wipe you out till now. So then, what are you worried about? Right? This is what are you worried about? V'rei atem kaimim lefanav. You're still here. Which means you survived the Cheta Meraglim and the Cheta Egel. What's the matter? Moshe sounds like a parent over here. That I didn't kill you till now, so your future is quite bright. And the truth is, again, Rashi felt this need to add this. He said, I already explained in terms of... he already explained in terms of Pshat. So Rashi's adding in the Tochach. Correct. It's a very astute comment. It's actually based upon a Ramban, and it's based upon a Zohar, where the Zohar tells us that Rav Shimon by a Tikkuni Zohar, it says that Rav Shimon by Yochai had left his other colleagues, and he was hiding someplace in a cave. And one day in the Beit Midrash, a question comes up. It says, hold it. At the end of the Tochacha and Vayikra, there are guarantees. It says you're going to come back and so on. At the end of the Tochacha and Devarim, there's no guarantees. And they say, woe unto us, for if only Rabbi Shimon were here, he would know how to explain this. So, and Rabbi Shimon's not here to explain it. So it said that there was a bird flying overhead and the bird stopped. And one of the rabbis, I think it was Rabbi Yehuda Ben Eli, decided to sit down and write a letter, gives it to the bird. He says, go find Rabbi Shimon wherever he may be. So, of course. So it was a Yonah, it was a dove. It says Yonah, a dove, the symbol of peace, the symbol of the relationship with God and the Jewish people. And it says all that clearly in the text. And then it says that it goes and flies and finds Reb Shimon. Reb Shimon gets the letter. He reads it. He starts to cry. And he says, what if future generations notice this? They may give up hope. They may give up hope that there'll never be an end of the second exile. And it says that he started to cry. And Eliyahu HaNavi, who was flying around anyway, happened upon him. And he said, I was actually on a different mission, but I see you crying, so I came here to dry your tears. And Eliyahu HaNavi goes and explains that even at the end of the Tochach over here, now he doesn't say what Rashi said and what Rav Soloveitchik said, but what he said is that, but in this week's parasha, we have a number of references to tshuva, and it's all dependent upon tshuva. It's all dependent, right. Right. So he was just taking the Zohar then. The whole point was the Tikkuni Zohar, which says the whole thing is based on tshuva, man does tshuva, and then the exile will come to an end. But what Rashi's doing over here is quite interesting, because Rashi's not even going that far. Rashi's saying something else. I didn't kill you till now, so your chances of survival are excellent. If we'll just continue a little bit in Rashi over here, Pasuk Yadalid. Well, Pasuk Yadalid, I'm not sure if we read. Yeah, those who are here today, those who are not here today. So Rashi says the obvious interpretation, Afim Derota Etitim Liot, that this covenant is being made with future generations who are not here yet. Pasuk Tedvav, V'tiru Chikut Zeved Kulechem Eitz Ve'Evin Kesef Azav Asher Imahem, Pen Yesh, but maybe we'll go before that. Pasuk Tedvav, ki atem yadatem et asher yeshavnu mitzrayim ve'et asher avarnu mekir v'goyim asher avartem, v'tir'u et shikutzeihem ve'et giluleihem eitz ve'evan kesef v'zahav asher imahem, pen yesh bachem isho isha u'mishpacha u'shevet asher levavot ponei ayom me'im Hashem Elokeinu lechet la'avod et Elohei agoyim ahem, pen yesh bachem shorish parer rosh v'lana. Now, what's really interesting about this pasuk, Moshe says, well, perhaps within the hearts of one of you is somebody who is not complete and somebody who is interested in idolatry and will be influenced by other generations, and perhaps it will be future generations, and so on. What's really interesting about the text over here, and I just want to stress, it's the text itself, is that if we recall on a midrashic level, this is both the Gemara in Pesachim and various midrashim Bereishit Rabbah, if I'm not mistaken, by Midbar Rabbah, it tells us about the death scene of Yaakov Avinu, that Yaakov suddenly loses his clairvoyance. He gathers everyone together. He wants to theoretically give them brachot. And then he starts, according to the Midrash, he starts to wonder, maybe there's somebody here whose heart is not complete. And if anybody remembers those whole Midrash, that's when they all say Shema. If you remember those whole Midrashim, they're very interesting. It's the Pshat in the Psukim over here. Which means what the Midrash puts into the mind of Yaakov is actually what the Psukim say over here. And the parallel, I think, is much more interesting, because the parallel over here is, on the one hand, you have the so-called brachot of Yaakov, and then you have the brachot of Moshe coming up. And prior to the brachot of Yaakov, we have this fear. Prior to the brachot of Moshe, we have this fear. But it's not, as I said, on a midrashic level, it's absolutely expressed. So what perhaps we had never noticed is that whole death scene of Yaakov, which is clearly closely related to the death scene of Moshe, and we always imagined it was because of the similarity in terms of the brachot, now we realize that the midrash over there, which expresses Yaakov's, at least in terms of the text, Yaakov's concerns, which were unarticulated, are based upon the articulated concerns which Moshe Rabbeinu gives over here. So I'm just pointing out that wasn't with even going to Rashi. That's just reading the words which it says in the Chumash over here is what, as I said, comes into his concern. The other part, which is perhaps a little bit more subtle, is that the concern is about future generations. It's not just what's going on over here. You're going to enter the land of future generations. And if you recall Rashi, at least, going throughout Parshat Vayichi, it's constantly that Yaakov, through his clairvoyance, sees future generations, and that's what scares him a lot. He sees descendants of various people. You know, where did this come from? What's going on over here? And so on. So perhaps there'll be future generations. So what I'm pointing out is the whole midrashic sense of what happens by Vayichi is actually based upon the narrative that we have over here in our parsha, and I believe there's a lot more to be said about this. Now, as far as the future generations go, I want to put it in a particular framework. And as I said, I want to get to Rosh Hashanah as well. So the big challenge over here was trying to find that segue to go from one to the other, but it's not as Let's start like this. If I blew the shofar already, and this is where I'm about to enter into huge machloket, if I blew the shofar already, can I blow it again for someone else? And the answer is obviously yes. Can I make the bracha again? Okay, let's leave the shofar, because I picked the shofar example because of Rosh Hashanah, but even though that becomes a serious machloket, what about by Kiddush? If I made Kiddush, can I make Kiddush again? So what's the answer? I can make Kiddush again. Why? I already made Kiddush. I was already Yotze Kiddush. Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh L'Zeh. So now the question is, what does that mean? Kol Yisrael Ravim Zeh L'Zeh. Actually, that is mentioned over here in this week's parsha. It says that when they cross over the Yarden, this is what Rashi explains, on Hanistarot, on that pasuk, Lanu V'Neinu Ad Olam, Aniglot Lanu V'Nistarot L'Hashem Elokeinu, right? On that pasuk, it says that we have responsibility for one another, and that begins when we cross the Jordan, and by Har Gerizim and Har Eval, which, by the way, may very well be another covenant which is made. That's why I also refer to multiple covenants. But the crossing of the Jordan is when this mutual responsibility happens. So let me ask you a very bad question. So if somebody missed Kiddush in the middle of the desert, I couldn't be Yotze him on Kiddush? So presumably, based on Rashi, the answer would be no. So why not? I mean, we all receive the Torah, so why is mutual responsibility only begin at a later part? And obviously the answer is certainly sitting over here in Yerushalayim, and certainly a Zionist answer. And the Zionist answer is that the identity of the Jewish people takes upon a whole new facet when we enter into the land of Israel. We're not simply a bunch of different individuals. Perhaps the difference between the religious experience in the diaspora versus one in Israel is one of Reshut HaYachid versus Reshut HaRabim.
It's the idea of putting on tefillin, the difference in putting on tefillin. Golus, which is preparation for putting on.
Right, right. Which isn't only the Ramban, it's also Rashi, as I think that we had seen. The story with Rav Huttner was that when he was on the plane on the way to Israel, it was time to daven, he put on tefillin. When he landed, he put it on again, and he said, because there is, it's a Rashi, by the way, is that there is another level of the mitzvah to put it on in Eretz Israel. So But what about mutual responsibility? As I said, yes, here we are a nation and there we are guests within other nations. Our sense of nationhood is not complete when we're outside of the land. But this mutual responsibility, why should this make a difference in terms of Kiddush? Now, the way that this idea of mutual responsibility is mentioned by the Ran, and I believe the Ritva, is it's not that I have responsibility for you as a separate individual. If you didn't say Kiddush, then I have not completely fulfilled my obligation of Kiddush. Which means the way that they articulate it is that I have an obligation to say Kiddush multiplied by all the Jews in the world. So therefore, if you didn't hear Kiddush, so that means my fulfillment was incomplete. It wasn't that I completed the mitzvah. My fulfillment was incomplete, and that's the reason I can say the bracha again. And that's the way that Ron says it. And that really, I think, expresses this concept of mutual responsibility in a more profound way. But there's another level to this. It is beautiful. It's very nice. It's very nice. There's another level to this. Because till now, the way that we just now multiplied it is in terms of every Jew who exists right now. But that's not what we were told in the Parsha. In the Parsha, we were told that it's also every Jew who will ever live, which means it goes in two different directions. Now, admittedly, it didn't talk about mutual responsibility, but it talks about the covenant. The covenant includes those who are here today and those who are not here today, which means it's not just in terms of the broad going this way, it's also going multiple or multi-generational, going backwards and forwards, or to put it in a term which Rav Soloveitchik did use, in terms of ownership of the land of Israel. God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. Which Jewish people? So therefore, for example, if every single Jew in the world right now says, you know what, enough of this, we've caused so much problems, maybe going to Uganda would have been a better idea. Let's just give up on this and let's all move over. Actually, it's not Uganda today, because the part of Uganda we would have gotten is today Kenya. Yeah, it's Kenya. We would have gotten Nairobi. I never told you this. I was once invited to speak in Nairobi. And long story, but I only agreed because my wife likes to travel and she ended up not coming with me. But I was in Nairobi. And I was told that he asked, of course, where did the community begin? How did it start? What are Jews doing here? Jews get lost all over. So the original Jews who came to Nairobi had inside information about the speech that Herzl was going to give about the Uganda plan, and they traveled then. They started buying up all the land that would one day become Israel, and they became the owners of the big hotels and so on and so forth. And they're still their descendants are still there. The grandson of the first couple there told me, just you know, for history's sake, he said the name of his grandmother and grandfather were Sarah and Abraham. They were the first Jews to come to Nairobi. So let's just say that all of us together say, okay, enough of this. We've tried. This hasn't worked out very well. No one likes us. We'll move to Nairobi. The whole world will suddenly love us, and all anti-Semitism will disappear completely. We'll become the darlings of the world. And so we hereby formally renounce our ownership of the land of Israel. Is that binding upon our children? So Rav Soloveitchik said no, because the land of Israel was given to the Jewish people. So which Jewish people? It was given to the totality of the Jewish people throughout the generations, past, present, and future, which means any and every generation are simply caretakers. We're not owners. We don't own the land of Israel. We are part of a much greater collective who are the owners. So all that we are temporary caretakers. The same thing would be true in terms of Torah. God gave Torah to the entire Jewish people. And now we'll go back to this verse. And the way Chazal used this verse by saying, not just you are here today, also future generations aren't here today. That applies to Sinai. Presumably, if this covenant by Arvot Moav is meant to re-establish the one at Sinai, so therefore it means that all generations accepted that which happened at Sinai. So that's the way that I'll try to nuance it then, which means that God gives the Torah to every single generation. If that's the case, who owns the Torah? Every generation. Which means if a student comes and wants to learn, I say, listen, I'm not going to teach you. I am stealing from them their inheritance. This does not belong to me. This belongs to them absolutely the same way it belongs to me. And that's why the Gemara refers to Torah as an inheritance to the Jewish people. But again, I'll say, which Jewish people? This collective. So that means that anytime we talk about Yisrael, it's, and this is not just within a mystical concept of, you know, all souls and so on. No, it's within a very rational legal perspective, that the Jewish people means the sum total of all Jewish people throughout history. That's who the covenant over. That's exactly what our pasuk is saying. Now, keeping this in mind, I do want to move over to something from Rosh Hashanah, which is a Gemara which I think deserves a lot more thought than we normally give it, and that's in source number 3. Michlal de Rosh Hashanah Leika Hallel. The Gemara over here, we, as you see, are jumping in the middle. The Gemara's observation is that when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, we don't say Hallel. So now I can ask you, well, why don't we say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah? So the Gemara says, my taima. What does that mean? Why don't we? What's the reason? Why don't we say Hallel on Rosh Hashanah? Amar Rav Abahu. Rabbi Abahu said the following. Now, this is beautiful because this is a peek into what's happening in heaven. And the perspective from heaven may be very different from the perspective below. Omri Abahu, Omru Malchei HaSharet Lefnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The angels have actually an accusative argument against the Jewish people. Rabbonu Shel Olam, Master of the Universe. B'bnei Ma'in Yisrael Amrim Shira Lefanecha B'Rashon Av Yom Kippurim. Why don't the Jews say Shira, which over here in this context means Hallel, praise, songs of praise, and Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Now, all of us know the answer. God will give the answer. But the truth is that the fact that the angels are asking this from their perspective is absolutely fascinating, and I'll come back to that in a moment. Omer Lahem, God says, Efshar Melech Yoshev Al Kisei Din. Can it be in a situation where a king is sitting in his throne of judgment, V'sifrei Chayim V'sifrei Metim Petuchim Lefanav, and the books of the living and the book of the dead are opened in front. V'Yisrael Omrim Shira. Are the Jews really going to sing songs of praise in such a situation? So that's the answer that God gives. But I want to go back to the angels' perspective. What are the angels saying? Meaning, the angels have a perspective from heaven, and they know perhaps better than anyone how the judgment actually works out in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. How does it work out? It's pretty similar to the Rashi that we saw before. You know, we're still around. We're still here. We make it year after year. We're still here. Which means that from the perspective of the angels, they're basically, I want to say laughing at God, but they're saying, what are you talking about, a day of judgment? Based on the way that Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur work out, the Jews should be singing Shira. Which means their argument is an accusation. They should be, God's defense of us is, yeah, it's a day of judgment. But again, I'll ask, it's a day of judgment, but how does the day of judgment work out? So I'm just saying is that there's dual perspective between the angels and between God. And just realize that God is acting over here as a defensive attorney, and God has this wonder, excuse me, and the angels have this wonderful perspective about what really happens in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, a perspective that I think that sometimes we don't necessarily fully appreciate. Now, but there was a turn of phrase over here, which is very interesting. There's a Gemara which is around 15 pages before this, which is much more famous. Amar Rav Kuspidai, Amar Rav Yochanan, says there are 3 books opened on Rosh Hashanah, right? Sifrei Tzadikim, Sifrei Rishayim, and the Beinonim. On Rosh Hashanah, people are written for life, people, the Tzadikim are written for life, the wicked are written for death, and then you have the Beinonim, who Tluim V'omdim, who are held in abeyance. Apparently, this Gemara is not talking about the 3 books. First of all, if it were talking about the 3 books, what would it say? That there are 3 books open. It doesn't say that. This Gemara is apparently talking about something else. And it doesn't say it doesn't say the books for the Tzaddikim, for the Rishayim. What does it say? Sifrei Chayim v'Sifrei Metim. Now, the word Sifrei Chayim means the book of those who are alive. The Sifrei Metim means the book of those who are already dead. The book of those who are not alive. So this is a question which was posed to Rav Chaim Volozhin. He asked, again, that was precisely his understanding, and he asked, well, it doesn't seem to make very much sense. I understand why God would judge the living to see what they've done, but what have the dead done recently? Why should they be judged? And the answer which is given is that on every year in Rosh Hashanah, God opens up the book of those who are living and opens up the book of those who are no longer living and judges them both. They judge the living for what they've done recently, and they've judged those who are no longer living for how they have impacted the world recently. Now, of course, you can say that there are some who are no longer with us who no longer have any impact. Okay, that itself is computed within the judgment. I mean, I mentioned this yesterday, and I asked Rashi, for example, how much Torah has Rashi taught this year? I'm saying, how many people today will read, we read a comment of Rashi, how many, again, just conservative estimate of how many people in the world today will read a Rashi?
It's limited. It's not limited.
I'll ask again, how many people in the world today will read a Rashi? How many people in the world today will read a Rashi? Okay, we have between hundreds of thousands and millions, whatever. Today, how many people today will read a Rashi? Right, it's easily hundreds of thousands of people. Easily hundreds of thousands of people will read Rashi today. A matter of fact, I'll tell you a secret. More people read Rashi today than will read Harry Potter. No, I'm being absolutely serious.
If you have the Book of the Dead, yes. The people who didn't accomplish anything are diluting and diluting and diluting the accomplishment.
You have to be negative, but perhaps. but again, what this is telling us is that God looks and looks at the dead people. Okay, now what? I'm saying how many people in absolute numbers studied Rashi today? I would say probably 800. I'm making a number. I would say 800,000 people today. Right. Anybody sitting learning Gemara, will look around. And, right. No, Gafiomi, I don't know. But okay. but you all understand my point. Is that right? Right. So therefore, my point is that Rashi has had a better year this year than most rabbis. Right. I'm saying Rashi had a good year. God opens up, and Rashi's impact on the world is one which is profound. And I can say the thing about the Rambam, and we can go in the list of people who's so God opens, right. Right. So again, you can look that there are people who are still having they're still impacting the world in a positive way. And that's something which is, on Rosh Hashanah, according to this Gemara, it is computed. But that's what's interesting, because that goes exactly back to our Pasuk. What did our Pasuk say? That the covenant is with those who are here and those who aren't here, which means those who aren't here means that those who are not alive yet. But what happens on Rosh Hashanah? On Rosh Hashanah, God judges the totality of the Jewish people. He judges the totality of the Jewish people, which includes people who are here and people who are no longer here. So I'm just saying that this Gemara, I think very in a very interesting way, tells us, you know, again, the continuation of what we're reading in this pasuk. Yeah?
No, this concept that the dead are being judged.
Right.
We can only do for them, right?
Right. So I'll say it again. If I open up a Rashi and I read a Rashi, did Rashi's impact on the world just now increase? The answer is yes. Now, can I do the same thing for a grandparent? Can I do the same thing for a parent? Can I do the same thing? Yes. Which means that we have the ability of changing the past. Now as strange as this may sound, let me forget about this broader concept. Let me take this in a very narrow sense. Let's just say this particular year, one of us perhaps made a mistake at some point and sinned in some way. Right? We have lots of mitzvahs. We have 613 opportunities at least in order to mess something up. So we messed up. So then comes to Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, comes to Elul, it comes to Seres Yom Teshuvah. So we have this thought, you know what, that may have been a mistake. right? It's not worth it. I'm sorry I did this. I wish I wouldn't have done it. I have charata. I have kabbalah la'atid. I say I'll never do it again, and so on and so forth. So don't we all believe that we can change the past? Don't we all believe that we have the ability of wiping something out that we did? So now the only thing that I added right now is I went back to this concept of mutual responsibility, and I said that just like when you didn't say Kiddush, it's not that you didn't say Kiddush, it's just a part of me wasn't Yotzei Kiddush as well. I'm just stretching out this concept of Klal Yisrael, and what I'm suggesting is that, yeah, people who are no longer here are still being judged, and you're saying, but they can't do any mitzvah, correct. But their impact on the world is something which is not static. The impact on the world is something which has the ability to change. You're troubled. Maybe. What I'll mean by that is that there is something that at the time it was done for a particular reason, a particular context, and so on. But later, because of a different orientation generally within life, now and retroactively, that now became a foundation for a different type of behavior. So that becomes reinterpreted because of the new behavior. So now, therefore, something that happened in the past is no longer what it was, it became something else. My favorite example of this, and it's part of an entire shir which I've given, I've written about, and I rewrote about it, which is about Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. But Reish Lakish, for those of us who don't know, Reish Lakish was at one point in his life considered to be a notorious criminal, somebody who was involved in a gang, somebody who the Gemara tells us of lives that were taken at his hand, somebody who was a gladiator, somebody who was involved in a circus and whatever, and he was, in simple terms, he is what today we would call a ruffian. He was a ruffian. He ends up doing tshuva, and the key phrase within his, you know, that moment when he turns around, is when Rav Yochanan says to him two words. He says, Chelech li'araita. You should be using your strength for Torah. And then he begins this whole life of Torah, where there's a lot to talk about, which I'm not going to say. At the very end, though, there is many years later, we don't know the time frame, there is a Gemara, which is in the Yerushalmi, it's Masechet Trumot, and it says as follows. It says that one day a messenger comes into the Beit Midrash with the following terrible report. And the report is that Rav Isi, or another Gersa is Rav Imi, was kidnapped. He was taken by this particular group of people, apparently far worse than Hezbollah and Hamas and whatever. And Rav Yochanan, who is the leading rabbi in the world, hears this, and Rav Yochanan says, may as well start preparing the funeral. Go by the shrouds, let's dig the grave, and it's over. Because there's no way that we can, there's no way. That's it. No one's ever been taken out once these people get their hands on them, so it's over. And then we hear another voice in the Gemara. The other voice is Reish Lakish. And Reish Lakish, he's one tough Jew. And Reish Lakish stands up and he says, over my dead body. Those are the words that he uses. The exact words are, either they're going to have to kill me, or I'm going to kill them. And it says, and by the way, the interesting thing then is the Gemara then says that Reish Lakish then goes and he finds these guys and negotiates with them and ends up getting him out. Now, what gave Reish Lakish the bravery, the chutzpah, but the tenacity, the skills, the skill set to be able to go and to challenge this whole gang of people? And they see, you know, by the way, this is like clearly, depending how old you are, this is like clearly, you know, Clint Eastwood, you know, coming at them. If you're younger, then I guess it could be, makes no difference. But it's this is Reish Lakish who's coming at them, and they never wanted a piece of Reish Lakish. They never imagined, you know, where's Reish Lakish today? And, you know, the old Reish Lakish is coming out, and he's got his guns. You know, it's an old Western. He's got his guns on him, or his knives on him, his swords on him, whatever it is. But he also, what's fascinating, is that he's able to negotiate and get them out without spilling any blood. But again, Rav Yochanan, he's dead. Reish Lakish, now, he succeeds. Now, when he succeeds in his earlier life, Reish Lakish only would have engaged in this kind of a thing because he wanted to rob somebody, or because he, or somebody looked at him the wrong way, but never because of something good. Now Reish Lakish is willing to endanger his life, willing to put himself on the line in order to save another person. So now I can say, in context, when Reish Lakish was a criminal, in context, he was a sinner, and he did things that are terrible. But once he uses the same skill set, but now he's using it Lashem, that's really the idea. That's really the idea that when somebody does tshuva, me'ahava, out of love of God, it turns his sins into zchiyot. By the way, who taught that? Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish is the one who taught that. So now I can't help but thinking, so what exactly happened in Reish Lakish's life himself, which is an unfair question, that he really got this understanding. I would assume that same day after Avimi is saved and they make a big party and so on, Reish Lakish comes to this understanding that if it weren't for his years as a sinner, there's no way that this man would have been saved. But at that point, it changes the past. At that point, his criminal past is not seen in a vacuum, as this is the bad part of his life, but now it can be reinterpreted as the foundation for perhaps saving somebody's life. So that's what I'm saying, is that the past is something which is very interesting, and the past is waiting for us to reinterpret it in a way that we can, and to use it in the service of God, and so on and so forth. Meaning, that's the greatest expression of free will. We always limit the concept of free will into thinking that I have free will today in order to do something tomorrow. It's present, it's a present thought, forward-oriented. Without realizing the greatest expression of free will is my ability to say I'm sorry for what I did yesterday and take away the sting from what I did yesterday and try to make amends for what I did yesterday, which therefore causes this fascinating interaction between the past, present, and future, and maybe even on some level takes us out of time. And that's why it's so interesting that we read the pasuk about Yom Kippur. What does it say? Lifnei Hashem Titaru. In front of God, you come completely prepared. What's Hashem? Is Yud Kei Vav Kei. What is Yud Kei Vav Kei? Ha Yehovah V'yiyah. Which means it's this ability of standing in front of God, which to a very great extent really transcends time in a certain way. And therefore, we live in this concept of time, but which is all, let me put it this way, and I'm sorry if I'm getting too complicated, and I'm very fearful where we're going to get in terms of where I wanted to go, but the world is based upon the world that we live in. How does it begin? Correct. Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz. What does the word Bereshit mean? Bereshit is the beginning. What does Bereshit do? It creates a time frame. Reshit, the beginning, so now there's time. What is there before Bereshit? Which is a very strange question. There's no time. Bereshit begins a time frame. Bereshit bara Elokim. So which aspect of God is included within the time frame? It's Elohim, which is Midat Hadin. Bereshit Bara Elohim. The Zohar, again, it's the Tikkuni Zohar, actually says that Bereshit Bara Elohim is the first thing that Yud Kei Vav Kei created was Elohim. Bereshit Bara Elohim. The first thing created was Elohim, which means God, who's outside of time, creates time, but he creates judgment. This whole concept of judgment is connected with time. Judgment is connected with time. Forgiveness is connected with transcending time. Did that make any sense? If not, then I can't. No, I'll try. That judgment is connected with time. I did something in the past, I'll be punished today, and so on. And I'm stuck within time. Forgiveness has within it a capacity to transcend time. What I did in the past no longer is important because the time frame sort of melts. And who am I? I'm the one who stands in front of God, standing in front of God, having true regret. Suddenly the past, the present, and the future fall apart, and that's Lefnei Hashem Titaru.
Two aspects to the future. That may be one of the issues of history. We say, remember our parents in terms of what I do today. Which brings up the other problem, that when somebody sins, he's not only he is sinning, but he's indicated that his parents were going over that fail, because this is the impact that they had. When he does tshuva, then it brings back a change in terms of what the impact was, which is probably the issue of saying Kaddish on a Yahrzeit, which would indicate that this is what I'm able to do, therefore it impacts upon the parents.
Yeah, none of that would be particularly good if I actually did a USCO appeal over here. So that you can play on the guilt, and you have to give. That was your Zeta's Yisko appear. There you go. That's a Yisko appear, and that's why you have to give money to the shul. Okay, that's the because otherwise your parents failed, right? You could take your parents out of hell right now and by giving money to the building committee. Okay, I'm saying that's. It was to the poor Yerushalayim that. What I'm saying that and I know and I agree absolutely completely that's the concept over here. Now we're not going to have real time to get to that I had imagined us getting to would have been how all of this works in connection with Rosh Hashanah and what is the biblical name of Rosh Hashanah? It's never called Rosh Hashanah in the. It's called. Okay, good. It's called Yom HaZikaron or Yom Zichron Truah. Sorry, Yom Truah or Zichron Truah. Which means that within Rosh Hashanah, there is going to be a concept of memory. Let's see where we get today. Source number 4. Has a very interesting dialogue. Source number 4 is a Gemara in Brachot and Daf Lamed Bet. The Gemara has a very interesting dialogue. There must be some mystical reason why the last Gemara, Rosh Hashanah, was also Lamed Bet, Amed Bet. This one is Brachot, Lamed Bet, Lave, whatever. You can say anything you want about that also. This Gemara deals with the children of Israel who feel like a forlorn spouse to a Kaddish Baruch Hu. It goes exactly to the issue that Rashi had discussed, that God will never reject us as a people, but what happens if we feel that we've been rejected? What if we feel that we've been forgotten? What if we feel that we've been thrown away and so on? Which, again, could be the feeling of the collective Jewish people over the last 2,000 years of exile. And it starts off with the pasuk Vatomer Tzion Azavani Hashem Vashem Shachichani. Right? So who are we talking? Tzion, Zion. Azvani Hashem, God has left us. Left. And God has forgotten. So that's the starting point to the pasuk in Yeshayahu. And it goes back and forth over here between God and the Jewish people. And God says, what in the world are you talking about? I forgot you. And God goes on to say, and we're going to skip most of it, everything I do for you. Right? This is a lover's quarrel. And the God, Am Yisrael is the woman who feels that she hasn't been appreciated, she's been forgotten, and gets no attention anymore. And God, who has been somewhat distant, says, what are you talking about? Everything I ever do, I'm doing for you. Finally, we'll turn to the top of page number 2. Amr lefan of Ribono shel Olam. What had previously been said is God says, I remember all the offerings that you brought. God says, I remember all the offerings. Right? Why does God remember all the offerings? Because God doesn't forget. God says, can I forget all the offerings, which means all the presents, all the things you've ever done, I don't forget. So now once God says he doesn't forget, I'm going to say this is a perfect lover's quarrel, because when God says he doesn't forget, so then what does Am Yisrael say back? Amr lefan of Ribono shel Olam, hol ve'in shichecha lefnei kisei kvodecha, which that line ends up making it into our Rosh Hashanah davening, shema lo tishkach li ma'aseh egel. So that means that you're not going to ever forget the egel. You won't forget that I cheated on you. You just said you never forget, which means, again, this forlorn woman turns back to God and says, that's why we have all the problems. God says, I'll never forget all the good things you did. He says, that's the problem. You never forget. You never forget, and that's why we have this kind of a relationship. Omar la gam eila tishkachna. That I forget. The eagle I forget. You forget. So that you're going to forget that we said Naseh v'nishma, which is really when we took our vows. So the Gemara is here very interesting, going, hold it, does God forget? And God doesn't forget. And how could it be that God forgets? Theologically, how can God possibly forget? And this whole Gemara says, Amar lav, anochi lo eshkachech. I never forget, I never forget Har Sinai. I forgot the eagle. Now, what does this mean? And obviously, this Gemara, I can say that it uses some anthropomorphic Dibur Torah B'Lashon B'nei Adam. The Maharal has a whole explanation of this, explaining what this means. But I'm saying there is a difficulty over here. The difficulty over here may actually be paralleled to something that maybe we don't think about enough. When we deal with Amalek, what do we say? Timched Zecher Amalek, Al Tishkach, right? Zachor Al Tishkach, Timched Zecher, Timched Zecher, that can be Zachor. Meaning, how does this memory and blotting out the memory, how does this coexist? But I'm just saying, this may be a parallel issue. And the reason why that may be even more significant is that we do have a similar discussion in the Psikta in source number 5, which again, we skip most of it. Am HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ani Ein Lefanai Shechecha. I don't forget. V'zachor ni ma'asu atem, shatem basar v'dam, v'atem shechichim. Havei zachorim ma'asa lachem amalek, kdei shetimche shmo min ha'olam. Zachor tasher asachal amalek, timche etzeicher amalek. So this, it's exactly this issue of memory versus forgetting and so on being used over here. The reason why Amalek is so interesting within all of this is the battle with Amalek actually impinges upon God's throne. Yes or no? You know what I'm talking about. In source number 6, Pasuk Tetzayin, Vayomer ki yad al keska milchama shem Amalek midor dor. Rashi over here comments, why is it, it's based on the Gemara, why kes and not kisei, that God's throne is imperfect as long as there is an Amalek, this negative force in the world. So what we're trying to understand here is really this combination between remembering versus forgetting. And now we can move over to source 7, which is from the Tefillah. Ata zocher ma'asei olam, ufaked kol yitzuri kedem, lufanecha niglu kol talmot v'amon nistarot shem mibreshet, ki ein shechecha lefnei kisek v'decha, ve'ein nistar b'neged einecha. So is that supposed to be comforting? If God remembers everything, so it goes back to this exact discussion. If God remembers everything, we are in a great deal of trouble, deep trouble. Now, on top of all that is when we...
Isn't the same thing to say if you're looking at what the dead people did, and that's in the cheshbon, so you can put something in the past out of the cheshbon, and that's not forgetting,
very
it's
good.
Remembering it, but it's not the cheshbon.
Very good. I'm going to go even further than that, but very good. Very good. Source 8 is we see where Rosh Hashanah is referred to as Zichron Truah. And source number 9, Rashi says Zichron Truah. Zichron, Psukei Zichronot, Musay Shofar wrote, Luskor Lemakeh that Yitzchak Shekar of Tachtav Ayel. Now, what we're going to skip, which I wanted to do, is the important Ramban on this, which is source number 10. That would have been very good, but that's what we're not going to have time to get to, but we're going to talk about this, maybe, but it's after Rosh Hashanah next week. But the important line in the Ramban is, let's turn to page 3. In the middle of the Ramban, it's bolded, and it says, it's towards the end of the line, which, by the way, goes exactly back to where we began today. The end of this tochacha, the end of Kitavo, leads into this week's parsha, which talks about tshuva. Right? Rosh Hashanah Yom Din B'Rachamim V'Yom HaKippurim Yom Rachamim B'Din. First, what I want you to notice is the Ramban is talking about the very Gemara that we cited before. God's answer to the angels, what's happening, why don't they say Hallel? So that's exactly what he just now quoted. It's Melech Yoshev HaKisei Din. That's what he quoted our Gemara. But then he labels Rosh Hashanah Yom Din B'Rachamim V'Yom HaKippurim Yom Rachamim B'Din. So here, I can assure you that Rabbi Soloveitchik gave a long lecture explaining this. If you want to see it in a shortened way, I will recommend that you get his least sold book, apparently, which is the Machzor of Rosh Hashanah, of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Art School told me it's the least sold book they ever printed, because apparently Art School people won't buy Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Soloveitchik people won't buy Art School. So it was a perfect marketing ploy over here to get no one to buy. That's who published it. So that is perfect. And because they sell so few, apparently you can get a good deal if you approach them. And, but I certainly recommend the one for Hashanah, Yom Yom Kippur. It can keep you entertained. If you need to speak in the middle of davening, you can find things to say as well. You don't have to prepare beforehand, and so on. Okay. But the Ramban added to this a key phrase. As I said, that's what needs to be explained. That Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Din Barachamim, the Yom Kippurim is Yom Rachamim Bedin. So that is really what would require much more time to explain, and we are running out of time. So let me at least try, in the briefest possible way, what is our basic gesture in Rosh Hashanah? The basic gesture in Rosh Hashanah is not a day of judgment. Because in Rosh Hashanah, we don't make any mention to the mistakes that we made. On Rosh Hashanah, we don't fast. On Rosh Hashanah, we conduct it. The only thing we do is we blow the shofar. That's all that it is. Yom Zichron. Right, right. The only thing we do, and on a Torah level, you would blow it on Shabbat as well. We blow the shofar. That's all that we do, and therefore if it's a day of judgment, the judgment is hidden. The din is hidden on Rosh Hashanah. On Yom Kippur, it's a day of forgiveness. Yom Kippurim, right? You can't be more clear. It's a day of forgiveness. I'll try to ask again. How do you know it's a day of forgiveness? What's it called? Yom Kippurim. If anything, what should Rosh Hashanah should be a scarier day? Yom Zikaron, right? It's a day that God remembers everything. That's very scary. What's Yom Kippur? It's a day of forgiveness. On the other hand, what happens in Rosh Hashanah? On Rosh Hashanah, we sort of conduct ourselves. Yeah, it's a more serious day, a little more davening, but the main thing is blowing the shofar. But on Yom Kippur, it's a day of forgiveness, but what do? We fast and so on, and we say, Hashamnu, Bagadnu, right? So that's exactly what the Ramban is referring to over here, that Rosh Hashanah is a Yom Din Birachamim. It's a Yom Din, but it's conducted Birachamim. Yom Kippur is Yom Rachamim Bidin. It's a day of forgiveness, but it's conducted by Din. As I said, that's the simplest way to explain this Ramban. Source 13. Source 13 is also found in the Yerushalmi, but the Yerushalmi, I do not believe, Yerushalmi I have in Source 14, but Source 13, it's the introduction, which is important. Rav Yoshi, Aktiv, Ashrei Am Yodei Trua, V'chi Yisrael Yodim Trua, V'ein Umot Olam Yodim, we're the only guys who know how to play a flute, know how to play an instrument, know how to play a wind instrument. Ela Ashrei Am Sheyodim Liftot Bor Am B'Trua. We know how to, the word is actually seduce God. Lefatot. Bitrua. Ve'ematai, bechodesh hashvi'i, bechadachodesh, and so on. Ktiv, now a couple lines later. No, we'll skip even more. Three lines to the bottom. Ukiyotze bo, b'rosh Hashanah, im yitzka shofa b'rosh Hashanah b'ir, v'im lo, yichardu miyom hadin. Which means the thing which prevents yom hadin is the fact that we blow the shofar. Now that went back again to the Gemara that we had quoted before. And despite our being somewhat blasé about it, it's decided who will live and who die. Yazov Darko Mutav. If you do tshuva, this is very good. Why? She'ena kadosh baruch hu chafetz b'mitatam shel rishaim. So skip a little bit now, and here's where this is a famous midrash. Third line. Shalu l'chachamim, nefesh achotim ma'ansha. Wisdom was asked, which is the rabbis. What happens to somebody who sins? Amar chotim tirdaf ra'a. Terrible things will happen to sinners. Shalu l'nevuah achotim ma'ansha. Amar v'nefesh achotat tamut, death. Shalu l'torah chotei mansho, amar yavi asham v'yitchaper, that he should bring offerings. Shalu l'kadosh baruch hu chotei mansho, amul ya'aseh tshuva v'yitchaper. That God says that you do tshuva and that everything is okay. So I just want to point out, In the Midrash here, the context of this is Rosh Hashanah. That's what I think is normally lost. The context is Rosh Hashanah, and Rosh Hashanah should be a Yom Hadin, but what happens instead? What happens instead is the tshuva, but it's a Yom HaZikaron, it's a day of remembrance, God remembers. So this goes exactly to, I think, the direction that you were going. When a person does tshuva, the person becomes somebody else, which means reality gets changed because of tshuva. Even a rationalist like the Rambam, in Source 16, Kamama ulama alata tshuva, emesh hayaza muvdal me Hashem Elokei Yisrael. Yesterday, or last night, right before, this person was mazem muvdal me Hashem Elokei Yisrael. He was separate, but more than that, he was estranged from God. And here the phrase is Hashem Elokei Yisrael, shenema avinotechem ayum avdilim b'neichem levein elokechem. Tzoek ve'enu ne'ena. The person can scream and not be answered. And a person's good deeds can be ripped up in his face. There's very strong language. Right? God is saying, who asked you to do these things? And so on. And what happened today when the person did tshuva? What is mudbak b'shechina? He becomes one with the Shechina. Shenema vatem hadvekim b'Hashem Elokeichem, clings to the Shechina, if you prefer. Tzoek, now he can scream, v'ne'ena, miyad. Now immediately he gets responded to. Shenema v'yater mikrova ani ene. Before you even call out, v'osem mitzvah u'makavlinoto, b'nachat, v'simcha. Now a person does a mitzvah, God accepts it. Shenema kikvar ratzah lukim masech, v'la'od elo shemit avim lahem shenema, and so on and so forth. The person's changed. So what causes this change? What causes the change is tshuva. By tshuva, this person becomes a different person. He no longer is the person he was. But you can say, what do you mean? The same way you can say, how can you change the past? How can you change the present? How can you change who you are? The reality, changing who you are, is in a sense denying the past. You say, what are you talking about? You are the person who did all these things. No. The person who did all these things was rejected by God. The person who says to God, I'm sorry, becomes somebody else. It just becomes completely transformed into somebody else. And that is exactly the answer which was given in the Gemara. You look at wisdom, you look at prophecy, you look at Torah, you look at everything, and the future is bleak. But the person stands in front of God. God gives a completely different response. But that's this ability, that's exactly what tshuva is. Which means, now we'll go back to this idea of memory, this idea of Yom HaZikaron. The memory gets changed. Why does the memory get changed? Because the past has been changed. How has the past been changed? Because what you did yesterday no longer stands by itself as something which is negative. What you did yesterday now stands as the foundation for who you are today and who you're moving towards tomorrow. So once the change, and that's exactly, I would say, this two-part thing in terms of God's memory versus God. Of course God remembers everything. But the real memory of God, I'm going to say this again because it's not all that clear, the real concept of memory of God is really more connected to Midat Hadin and to judgment and God standing as judge. On the other hand, you know, there's a midrash that I skipped, maybe this is the last thing that we'll read. In source number 11, which is commenting on Avram Avinu arguing about God judging stone, Rav Levi, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. So what's the answer? Im olam atam mevakesh ein din, ve'im din atam mevakesh ein olam. Make up your mind. You want judgment? There's no world. You want real judgment? The world doesn't exist. You're willing to sacrifice real judgment, so now we can have the world exist. But I'm going to say this again. This is only based on Bereishit Bara Elokim et Hashamayim et Haaretz et Midat Hadin, and that's the famous Rashi in Source 12, Bara Elokim v'lo amar Bara Hashem. Why? Shebetchila ala b'machshava levroto b'midat hadin. But God knows that the world can't exist. So what? What happened afterwards? Shatfa rachamim v'din. That the world ends up becoming this combination. But what is this combination? It's this world is based Bereishit Bara Elokim, but there's this aspect of God which created the world, which is before creation. Let's put it that way. There's this aspect of God which transcends time. Yud Kei Vav Kei Lefnei Hashem Titaru. Which therefore, even this concept of memory, we look at memory really in a linear fashion. There is a past, there's a present, there's a future. But what happens if you happen to be God who's outside of time? And if you happen to be God who's outside of time, is the past, present, the future really what's significant? God lives in this constant, even to say constant present isn't really true, which means that the tshuva that I do now works because the past just isn't so important. So you say, "Ein shichcha lufnei kisei kavodecha nachon, lufnei kisei kavod, in front of midat hadin, in front of the king who's sitting in judgment, and so on." But if we do tshuva, all of that gets completely, completely changed. And that's the secret of Rosh Hashanah, which, by the way, we skipped the whole long Ramban. That's the secret of Rosh Hashanah. The secret of Rosh Hashanah is by blowing the shofar and accepting God as king over the universe, we're able to take the judgment and surround it with rachamim. We're able to take the truah, which is the real sound, and surround it with tkiah, and according to the way the Ramban explains this, it's really that the tkiah is rachamim, and the truah is din, and what we do is we surround the tkiah, we surround it with rachamim. And how do we surround it? Rachamim, by accepting God as the universe. The truah represents that kedat Yitzchak. It represents Yitzchak, who's surrounded by chesed, and rachamim, by Avram, and by Yaakov. And what we do is, just like by the Akedat Yitzchak, on the one hand there's this willingness to sacrifice everything for God, but the key part of the Akedat Yitzchak is that God doesn't accept it. The willingness was enough, and God doesn't accept it, and God is willing to take a ram instead of Yitzchak, and that's that ram horn coming to remind us that God is willing not to act as judge, and even somebody sitting on an altar, afilu cherev, right, is munachat al tzavaro shel adam, God is willing to say, okay, take it off of even the very last moment and put the animal on instead and save the human being, which means this ability of switching between din and rachamim is exactly what Rosh Hashanah is about. But all of this comes down to this one, same one idea, is that the ikar, the most important thing, is tshuva, because when we do tshuva, we totally transcend ourselves. And I had a feeling that maybe in some way, maybe, I'll just throw this out, you can argue with me, but you know, just like God transcends time, God transcends place. And maybe that's what it means when the Gemara says in Source 17, "The Amar Rav Avahu b'makom shabali tshuva omdin ein tzadikim gemurim omdin." That somebody who is a bal tshuva, the place that he stands is in front of God. Once a person did tshuva, that means he stands in front of God, who's outside of time. So just like God is out of time, the place is outside of place, as it were. And therefore, makom shabali tshuva omdin, tzadikim gemur lo omdim sham. Because this person is now in this profound presence of God, and at that point they transcend time, space, and matter, just as God does, and therefore the past becomes it's no longer relevant, in a sense.
Thank you for a positive approach to tshuva.
Okay.
Thank you.
You are?
Perhaps the key is, what's being judged is not the act, but the person. The person is changed. If, however, the act has contingent upon other people, then that enters into the equation, and therefore truly does.
Right. And there may be one more element, and the element is that sometimes we, again, you distinguished in the act and the person. I'll just add one more, which I think is what you meant. It's the relationship with God. It's not just the actions, the relationship with God. The relationship needs to be healed. Once the relationship with God is profound, then all kinds of impossible things become possible. Everybody should have a good Shabbos and have a Kesiv Tzimitova, a year full of health and prosperity and peace. And may God give you the intelligence to pray for good things and then answer those prayers.